Welcome to the Bringing Rural Back podcast, where we help you live a more prepared and sustainable life today so that you can have a better tomorrow no matter what. This is your host, Greg Carter, and this is episode number 40. In today's episode, we're going to be answering a few questions. I guess you could call this, I don't know, maybe a feedback show or something. It's kind of going to be kind of a mosh-posh. But before we do that, let's get some chores done. I'd like to remind everybody about our listener appreciation event. Sign up for the contest by going to the blog. There'll be a link there where you can just enter your name and email address and just promise that you will share the show in some way. There are several ways you can do it. I'm not going to follow up on you. It's just kind of the honor system. With that, let's get into the questions. The first question came from Vicky. Vicky lives in Western Maine. And it was kind of a follow-up question to planning next year's garden, an episode that I've done fairly recently. And she asked me if there were ways to find out specific varieties and specific things that she could plant in her area. That's a very good question, and it's something that a lot of people, especially first-time gardeners, do. She had a garden apparently last year, and it didn't do very well. So, you've got some tools, especially here in the U.S., and I'm sure that there are similar things that would apply no matter where you are in the world. First thing is going to be neighbors. You're going to be able to talk to other people who have a garden and find out what's growing. Now, if you're the only one in your area that has a garden, you know, that's going to be kind of tough. You're not going to be able to do that. But don't worry, there are other options, but I would try that one first. Now, the reason that I would try that one first is because, you know, there are things, and I've told this story. I moved just a county or two away in the past, well, several years now. And even though it was nearly the same zone, it was the same zone but a different subzone, agricultural zone, then there were some things that grew really well where I was before that didn't do real good where I am now. So I had to learn by trial and error. Now, if you're on a limited budget, trial and error stinks, because when you're buying plants, or you're buying especially plants, or you're buying seeds, you're putting out a capital outlay and you're not receiving a return on that investment. And gardening and fruit trees and vines and plants and all like that should be looked at as an investment. You should get a return. It's not like just ornamental flowers where the only real return you get is aesthetics. You're wanting food out of the deal. So first thing would be to try to talk to some local gardeners. Second thing is almanac.com, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes. Almanac.com, you can put in your zip code and it'll give you a list of some plants that should do well in your area. Now, here's the thing. The United States Department of Agriculture has split the U.S. up into agricultural zones. Now, what the heck's an agricultural zone? Well, an agricultural zone is basically your lowest low throughout the year. Okay? Now, I am in zone 7B. Depending upon which map you look at, because you can't get them to agree on anything, I don't reckon. I'm almost in zone 8A in some, and I'm solidly in 7B in others. Now, what that means is that our average low temperature is 20 degrees. Okay? Now, having said that, right now as I'm going home, about to hit the back roads, headed towards the house, it is 24. Feels like 18. Now, we've had several nights, or a few nights, not several, this year that, you know, we hit like 13, 12, stuff like that. But it's an average over so many years or whatever. Well, that ag zone will be able to tell you what cold hardiness your area can handle. Now, here's the problem. When I got the question from Vicky, I just put in ag zones for Western Maine. And what I found was very interesting. In that particular area, there are three different agricultural zones. And it's kind of weird. That's not very usual. So they actually have like a mini climate. It's not really a microclimate. It's a mini climate where they have a zone 3B, they have a zone 4A, and then they have a zone 5B, which is just a little circle around like one town. Okay. So when that comes into play, you definitely need to try to find somebody local if you can and talk to them. Okay. So, but almanac.com in conjunction with your agricultural zone is going to help you a ton. Also, almanac.com or the USDA website will be able to tell you your normally expected last frost date and first frost date. Okay? Now, what that does is that's going to give you your growing season. Now, up in Maine, certain sections, they have a very short growing season. Sometimes it's as short as June, late June to like early September. So you've really only got two solid months, maybe two and a half. That's going to limit some things. You'll have to look at cold hardy varieties up in Western Maine, and then get with almanac.com. It's going to help you a bunch. And that applies no matter where you are, because even if you've got a really long growing season, there's going to be some plants that just won't grow in your area, and that'll help you. Okay? All right. Next question was from a guy named Bill who was in Missouri. Now, Bill asks about composting. He wants to get started composting, but doesn't have a clue what to do. Okay? Now, here's the cool thing about composting. Can you do it wrong? Yeah, you can do it wrong. But you kind of have to try hard to do it wrong. Okay? Now, you can do it more right than others. Okay? But, I mean, there's a whole host of ways to compost. Most common, I guess, would be the compost tumbler. Which they run about $100. You can get them at most hardware stores and places like that. And they do a good job. I'm not going to deny it. If you're going to do a compost pile, it's fairly labor intensive. You basically need about a cubic yard, and you're going to have to turn it every so many days. Most common, I believe, is told is like 3 to 7 days, and you'll have to turn it. And then within 21 days, if the temperature's right, and then you'll have really good compost. Okay? All right. Now, the way that I tend to do it is a couple. I actually do a couple. One is I just put the compostable materials right straight in the garden. I dig a hole, throw it in there, and just cover it up and go with it. Don't sweat it. I don't worry about it. I don't think about it. I just let it go. Now, what that does is that puts the nutrients right straight into the soil. The problem with a compost pile is that a lot of your nutrients and everything off gas. Okay, I don't know if you've ever seen a well-worked compost pile, but you will start off with a cubic meter. Now, what's a cubic meter? A cubic meter is a little bit bigger than three, about three and a third feet by 3 1/3 feet by 3 1/3 feet. Okay? It's a big amount of material. It's a big amount. Now, so when it's completely composted, then the size of that material, the mass of that material, goes down a lot. It's reduced a bunch. Now, it does, it gets a good smell to it when it's done. It smells like good, rich dirt. And let me tell you something, that's a good smell, okay? At least it is to me, all right? But, you know, it's very labor-intensive, okay? You can do buckets, you can do garbage cans, you can do all this stuff. You can put basically anything in there that you want to put in there except for meat. Now, if you're going to bury it like I do, you can actually throw meat in there too, okay? Now, any herbivores, droppings, or manure can go right straight in there and compost as well. I do the bury method, and I do have a compost bucket, and it's got things in there like, you know, the peelings of cucumbers and peas and beans that wound up hanging out too long and we didn't eat, and onions drippings and all this stuff. It's got all this plant material. It also has shredded newspaper in it and eggshells and things like that. Now, in the bucket, I do not put any meats, okay? I don't put any manures in it. Coffee grounds, tea bags, anything like that. Now, it generates a heat because it's going to be a mixture of browns and greens, okay? Now, brown and green has nothing to do with the color of the material that you put in your pile or your bucket. It has to do with nitrogen content. All of your greens are nitrogen-bearing materials, okay? Your grass clippings, manures, anything like that is going to have a high level of nitrogen in it as far as what the end product will be. Your browns are your carbons, okay? Your carbons are things like your coffee grounds, your tea bags, your eggshells, things like that. You want a good mixture of the two. Now, there are people that tell you that, oh, you got to have this certain ratio. Well, I'm sure it'll help, but I've found that not to be absolutely necessarily the case. Now, what I do is I take some old compost and I mix it in with the stuff that's processed and new. Now, the reason I do that is the older compost, the good compost, the finished compost, has all these little microbes in it, and all the little bugs, and the bacteria, and all this stuff in there. And they help speed up the breakdown process. And I have found that it actually helps me produce a better end product. Even when you get done, there's still going to be some pieces that aren't quite completely gone unless you wait a really long time. Other methods that you can use, I'm actually going to cover two, called vermicomposting. Now, what vermicomposting is where you use worms to compost whatever you're doing, okay? Now, there are some special warnings when you're doing vermicomposting. You're not supposed to use any onions because onions will irritate the worms. You're not supposed to use any citrus. So in my regular compost bucket, I will put the onions and the citrus and all that stuff in it because my daughter absolutely loves lemons, okay? So the easiest two methods I know of vermicomposting, and the least expensive two methods I know, by the way, are one, requires two of the Rubbermaid rugged totes. One is left whole. One, you drill some holes in the bottom, you drill some holes in the sides, and you drill some holes in the tops. You put something in the bottom tote that is solid. You haven't put any holes in it. And to keep the second tote from seating all the way down in it. Okay? And then you put your stuff in there and you let it kind of ferment for about 2 weeks. And you're going to want to put some soil in there along with your coffee grounds and all that stuff. Okay? After it's fermented for about 2 weeks, then you add your worms. Now, they sell special composting worms, which are red wigglers. And the composting worms will break down the stuff a lot quicker. You do not want to add night crawlers to them. Okay? Night crawlers just can't hang. They can't handle it. Now, I have had success going to the bait store and getting just regular old red wigglers and putting them in there. And no, they've not been bred specifically for composting. And yes, it takes a little bit longer. But here's the deal. It's a heck of a lot cheaper to go buy the little thing of red wigglers and add them to it. And then as you're going along, they multiply. They control their population based on how much food you put in there. And, you know, if I want to go fishing, I just go to the worm bin and I collect worms and then I can go fishing. I don't have to go buy any red wigglers anymore unless I'm trying to repopulate or increase the population of my worm bin. Okay? So that's one way. It's real easy. Now, the second tub, the one on the bottom, the one that's solid, will collect a really funky looking liquid in it. And that's called worm tea. Okay, that's what they call it. And that's one of the best fertilizers in the world. In fact, that's primarily what I harvest. I just let them just chomp down, chomp down, chomp down, chomp down, chomp down, all they want to. And I collect the worm tea. Now, once you get to a certain level of volume inside it, then you can collect some worm castings, which just looks like a dark, deep, almost black dirt. Okay? And you can add that. But you're not going to get a whole lot of it. But the worm tea, you don't get a whole lot of it either, really, kind of. But when you dilute it and use it as a foliar spray, I mean, it just does a jam-up job. Okay? There are all kinds of videos on YouTube. I may be doing one here in the near future because I do mine just a little different. But, I mean, there's some good videos out there, and it's not a problem. It's pretty easy. All you need is the totes, drill bit, and I actually use screen on mine because I don't like the worms being able to get out. Now, here's one warning, okay? This cannot be in direct sunlight. Now, they can handle some heat, but if you've ever left a box of worms in a vehicle after you've gone fishing, the funk that they emit when they die due to heat is absolutely horrible. So you're not gonna want them in direct sunlight. They make one on Amazon that you can buy that's commercially made that will stay in your home. Moisture's your big problem. If you see worms trying to crawl out of your worm bin, then there's too much moisture. So you'll have to make some bigger holes to allow for airflow to decrease that moisture. The next one I want to talk about is actually probably the most hands-off way of vermicomposting. I mean, it's crazy stupid simple. Alright? So what you do is you take a 6-inch PVC pipe and a set of post hole diggers and a drill bit. That's the only tools that you have to have. I like cutting them off, cutting the 6-inch PVC off to about 3 feet. Okay. Some say 4 feet, some say longer. It's really up to you. After I explain it, you'll go, oh, yeah, okay, I can do that. All right. You take your post hole diggers and you dig you a hole. I like digging my hole about 2 to 2.5 feet deep. Now, this is why I do it at 3 feet. Okay. You drill holes in the side at least about halfway up of your PVC pipe. And then that PVC pipe goes in the hole. Then you just dump all your compostables down into the pipe. And then you've got to have some kind of cover. Now, I use a flower pot. It's what I use. I don't suggest you use the actual PVC cap because you're not going to be able to remove it. And you can paint it up and you can make it pretty and all like that. Now, the people who make their pipes longer, they do it so that they don't have to bend over when they're adding materials to this system. I want to just tell you that right off the bat. But I don't mind stooping down and dumping stuff in there. So that's I like to have mine about a foot above the ground and maybe a foot and a half. You know, depends on how cheaply I got the pipe. And then you just dump all that stuff in there. You wait about a week with it this way. And then you dump your worms over the top. Now, your worms will go out the little holes, and they'll come in the little holes, and they'll eat, because they're going to stay where the food is, and they'll eat everything, and then when it rains, all